is Rockies.
Thanks very much for having me back here. It's always a pleasure to come to Santa Barbara. I want to talk about increasing evidence that the world is a much less complicated place than our usual description of it would have us believe. This evidence suggests that local field theories have way too many degrees of freedom in them. Moreover, it suggests that if we want to overcome the apparent contradictions between the world of quantum mechanics and gravitation, we're going to need to understand how to get rid of these extra degrees of freedom and describe the world in a more economic way. To illustrate this, I want to start by asking a simple question, which is, we can ask how much information is contained in this room, right? And I don't mean in the books you brought or the laptops, but fundamentally, if we go down to the smallest constituents, right, how many bits of data do I have to specify to describe exactly the state of, you know, the physical state in this room? And that seems like a very silly question if we are doing quantum field theory and if I'm not imposing any limit on energy. Because if the contents of the room are described by quantum field theory, then there are independent degrees of freedom at every mathematical point in space, right? And with enough energy, there's nothing stopping me from exciting as many of them as I want and storing lots of information, right? So the first approximation here is number of degrees of freedom is infinity. But we can try to get a more conservative estimate, which I will later argue is still a vast overestimate. But let's be our most conservative selves and recall that there's such a thing called the Planck length, which is the square root of g times Newton's constant times h bar over the speed of light cubed. And that's about 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. And if you try to resolve features as small as that, you would find yourself frustrated because the quanta you're using to do that would form a black hole that's at least as large as the Planck length. So by increasing energy further, you just do worse and worse. You make bigger and bigger black holes. And that's why we believe that it makes sense to say that we shouldn't be talking about length scales smaller than that. And so in our conservative estimate, let's therefore divide up the volume of this room into tiny little Planck cubes, like this. And to be sort of almost Ashcroft conservative, let's assume that we have only a single binary degree of freedom in each of these in each of these little cubes. Okay, so I'm not going to put anything complicated here. There's just going to be, say, a spin pointing up or down, or zero or one, in each of these cubes. Okay, that should be centimeters here. So then I'm going to get n equals volume divided by Planck length cubed, many cubes. Okay, and that's the number of degrees of freedom I would then have in here. In other words, I would have two to the n states. Okay, and in this room, this is about 10 to the 108, and this would be the exponential of that. Now, I should point out that I'm using a few things interchangeably here, and we'll do throughout the talk. Things such as binary degrees of freedom, I will use that exchangeably essentially with entropy. That's correct up to factors of log 2. In other words, I will, if I have n states available, then the entropy is the logarithm of that curly n. And so that's why I can think of up to factors of log 2 as that being the same thing. Okay, so here's our estimate. It's very much finite. But now the claim is that gravity conspires to prevent us from ever accessing all these degrees of freedom. If you have that many degrees of freedom, then you would expect to have, you know, a lot of storage capability for data in this room. But you don't. What gravity does is it turns out that in the real world, to actually turn these little spins on and off or to encode information in fields, it costs energy. And the more information you want to encode, the more energy you have to pump into the room. Now, I wasn't giving you a ceiling for the energy in our initial estimate, but gravity gives you one that you can't escape. Namely, there's only so much energy you can put into this room before it will collapse into a black hole. Right? And now you've formed a black hole that's the same size as this room, and you can't put any more energy in because the black hole's just going to get larger and larger. And the one thing that I've limited is it has to fit in this room. Okay? So, gravity prevents us from ever having this much entropy. In fact, it gives us a very specific bound on entropy. It tells us that entropy has to be less than the area of the walls of this room divided by the Planck length squared. I'm setting C to 1 here, and I will probably be setting these guys to 1 soon as well. So that's very bizarre, right? It's, first of all, it's much less. In the example of this room, it would be about 10 to the 72 for the maximal entropy. Yes?
Can I just raise your objection to that statement?
Yeah. Sorry?
I just wish to object to your statement that gravity requires a bound in S less than A over 4. I actually want to distract you from your talk. I wish to object.
Okay. Well, maybe there will be a point later in the talk when you can object again and with more of a precise objection. Yeah, though it's certainly okay to be just objecting. So good. Well, in fact, this is definitely a very sloppy statement. But this is what this is a very short version of what this talk is mostly about. Yes, indeed. So in this example, gravity prevents us from having this much entropy because as we heat up this room, as we try to crank up the entropy, we will in fact form a black hole before we've reached this limit. Okay. Now, what's so bizarre about this is not just the enormous simplification that seems to be implicit in it. Right? These are very different numbers, and if we had chosen a larger room, then they would be even more different. But what's so remarkable about this is the scaling with the area. Right? That the maximum information you can have in a region has nothing to do with the volume of the region, but has something to do with the area of the boundary of the region. That's really bizarre, and that is intuitively immediately in conflict with the locality of quantum field theory. We think that there are independent degrees of freedom at each point, that kind of thing shouldn't happen. Okay. Now, what I want to do in this talk is essentially three things. I want to describe how this behavior came to be recognized by studying the thermodynamic properties of black holes. Then I want to describe, this is basically where my own work comes in to some extent, a more precise and more general bound than what I've just written down here, called the covariant entropy bound. Which has the advantage that, unlike this one, it can't be very easily violated by configurations where gravity becomes very strong, and for which we therefore have more evidence as being a fairly universal statement. And finally, I want to discuss briefly why we might hope that this gives us some clues about quantum gravity. So, to get to the main part of my talk, if there aren't any further objections. I want to go back to 1970 or so. I was told that students were encouraged to come here. So there was a graduate student called Jacob Bekenstein, who was thinking about a very nice Gedanken experiment. Very nice thought experiment where you have some matter system occupying, well, this is not exactly the experiment he was thinking about, but it's a modification of it, which is useful in to do in this talk. Some matter system occupying, for simplicity, a spherical region of space, right? And he was thinking about what happens when we convert this same region into a black hole of the same surface area that we had before. So we start out with some surface area A, right? And it's plausible, though certainly not rigorous, to assume that we can collapse some shell, some massive shell, very violently into this region to basically make up for the mass that's missing for this to become a black hole. Right? This matter system already has some mass. If we had a lot more mass, this would form a black hole of precisely this surface area. So let's shoot that extra mass in there. Okay, and then we can think of that as a thermodynamic process in which we end up with a black hole, which I'm going to draw with a cross through it so that we know it's a black hole. And we've arranged the extra mass in such a way that we get exactly the same surface area that we started from. This is a heuristic approach to this set of ideas, but it is ultimately very closely related to the line of thought that Bekenstein went through. So Bekenstein thought of this as a kind of thermodynamic process, right? And he noticed that it's a very profound thermodynamic process. So he takes the point of view of some observer who stays wisely far from the black hole and who is trying to trying to make sure that the second law of thermodynamics isn't violated. It's always a good idea to make sure the second law of thermodynamics isn't violated. So he starts out with some initial entropy as matter, and he ends up with a black hole. Okay, and now there's a very annoying theorem called the no-hair theorem, which was proven by the work of various people, including Israel, around 1970, and which tells you that when you form a black hole or when you throw something else into a black hole and you let the dust settle, very quickly the solution asymptotes to a stationary solution, which is described only by three quantities, mass, charge, and angular momentum. So that means that you can't send a probe close to this black hole and look for, say, tails of some matter fields that would betray whether you made this black hole out of elephants or out of camels, right? There's nothing here that distinguishes it from any other black hole with the same mass, and if you put in charge and angular momentum, that too, right? So what must have happened here, if you want the second law still to make sense for an outside observer, is that you've converted ordinary matter degrees of freedom, of which we understand the underlying quantum theory and the Hilbert space typically, into gravitational degrees of freedom where we don't. Right. So, and moreover, again because of the no-hair theorem, you can't think of these gravitational degrees of freedom as having some classical correspondence of little waves, perhaps ripples, or small imprints on the horizon of the black hole. The black hole is very pure, it's very simple, yet it has to contain at least as many, it has to be compatible with at least as many quantum states as the matter that I used to make the black hole. Right? So there, we have to assign entropy to a black hole even though we don't know what is the underlying Hilbert space. Now, to take a good guess at what that entropy might be, or how big that entropy might be, not what it actually consists of, Bekenstein was guided by another theorem that had just recently been proven by Hawking, called the area theorem. Which states that when you have a black hole, well, every black hole has an event horizon, which is the surface, in the simplest case, is a sphere of no return. Right? It's basically the sphere beyond which you better not go if you want to go back home. Right? This event horizon can only ever increase in physical processes. That's what Hawking proved under some fairly weak assumptions on the properties of matter. And that's not actually very hard to understand intuitively. Right? You can classically you can throw things into black holes, and that will make the black hole get larger, the area goes up, but nothing can come out. So unless you have negative energy available, there's no way to make a black hole smaller. So this was very helpful to Bekenstein in his plight, because he could look at this formula and recognize a similarity to some other law of physics that we believe to hold true, which is the law that tells us that entropy only ever increases. Right? And so that suggested the very simple identification between the area of a black hole and its entropy. So Bekenstein suggested that the entropy of a black hole is the area of the black hole in Planck units, since that's the only sensible dimensional unit you can come up with in this context. He didn't know about the exact prefactor here, but he suggested that this has to be true. And of course, it throws up a deep question, namely, what are the microstates underlying this entropy? And that's a question that's been debated in our branch of theoretical physics for more than 25 years now, well, 30 basically. Right. And it's been partially answered in some very limited circumstances in string theory. But I think it's fair to say that for a general black hole, we still have absolutely no idea what are these quantum states that underlie this entropy. Right? There should be e to the area quantum states, and we don't know what they are. So if you decide to go into this field, this is one of the things you should try to solve. This was, of course, not the only problem. I mean, this was a very deep insight that Bekenstein had, but he didn't tell us what the states are. And there was something else he didn't do, which you might call his greatest blunder, if you will. He had the chance at this point for an incredible prediction. Right? He had just said that black holes have entropy. And we know that black holes have mass. But if something has entropy and it has mass, then you can calculate from the first law of thermodynamics its temperature. Right. And right. So he could have predicted that black holes have a temperature, and if they have a temperature, they must radiate. But that seemed just too crazy, right? Black holes are the things that gobble everything up and give you nothing back. How can they radiate? Right. So he missed his chance here. Right? That's of course, you know, we all wish we were in a position to make such a blunder. But so it was only when Hawking did a completely different kind of calculation, and in fact, unlike these more semi-philosophical arguments, a real hard calculation of quantum field theory in a curved space background, that this set of ideas was confirmed. Hawking derived that black holes have a temperature, and in fact that they have precisely the temperature that is needed for consistency with the entropy that Bekenstein proposed. And they radiate, of course, not classically, but through a quantum process. He had to use an approximate scheme for mixing together techniques of quantum theory with gravity to get this temperature out. But he was able to calculate this temperature, including the exact prefactor, and that was what then, via this relation, fixed the prefactor for Bekenstein. That's where this one quarter is coming from. Okay. Now, at this point, we have a very nice story. Right? Everything's consistent. There's a black holes have temperature, entropy. They are thermodynamic objects. And we can start trying to use the arguments backwards. In other words, we can try to say, well, in this process, there's now a chance that the second law is not violated, right? Because I start with entropy S matter and I end up with entropy A. Okay, but of course it's not guaranteed that the second law is upheld in this process. It's going to be upheld only if the entropy of the initial matter system was less than the area that surrounded it. And the nice thing is that you can now forget about the entire messy operation of converting this to a black hole. Right, this better be true to start with. The area surrounding the matter system is already a property of the matter system, since we arranged the process to give us a black hole of the same area. So we can conclude from this kind of generalized second law that Bekenstein established, or proposed, I should say, that the entropy of a matter system surrounded by area A has to be less than that area in Planck units. Okay. And this is, yes. Is this where your objections can come? Yeah. So, would you like to?
Well, the objection is, of course, is only true for matter systems that can be converted to black holes by this process.
Right.
So there are two possible ways to go. One is to assume that all matter systems can be converted to black holes, and therefore satisfy this. The other is to suppose that because that a matter system which has too much entropy cannot be converted to a black hole.
That's right.
Cannot be fully converted to a black hole. And right. I will remind you that Raphael Sorkin and I wrote a paper last fall that strongly suggested that the Hawking effect, the radiation effect you just mentioned, that's exactly what happens. You had a system that was more entropic than a black hole, and you try to do this, you would end up not with a black hole, but you would, through these quantum mechanical effects Raphael alluded to, produce extra constant objects so the material is still.
Right. So there are. In fact, I should probably, as Don correctly points out, this is far from rigorous. And I think you should take what Bekenstein did and most of what I'm going to talk about today as a heuristic approach for learning something about physics, where you have to pick your preferences here and there. You have to decide which direction you're going to follow, which things you think are good hints and which are red herrings. And it seems that at least up to now, there's a good case to be made that Bekenstein followed the right direction there, and that he put his finger on an important idea. But it's certainly this is working by induction, as you usually do when you try to discover something new in physics. And I'm not claiming that any of the things I do are rigorous as deductions. In particular, In a few minutes, I'm going to say myself that this is in fact completely wrong for reasons that are different from the ones that Don mentioned.
So this is just a circle.
So this was as far as Bekenstein basically took it. Well, in fact, he wrote on a slightly different bound, but I don't want to go into that in this talk. The idea here is that, how do we resolve this contradiction with quantum field theory? Right? In quantum field theory, it looks like degrees of freedom should be extensive. Here it looks like they scale with the area. If the maximal entropy is given by the area, then that's presumably as many degrees of freedom as we have. And one way to think about this is, as we did in the beginning, to think of gravitational back reaction as punishing any attempt to exceed this limit, right? You try to crank up the entropy in this room. At some point, you've put in so much energy because there seems to be some connection in real matter systems between energy and entropy. At some point, you've put in so much energy that you get frustrated by collapse to a black hole. And so it's remarkable that it's such a simple law, but it's not implausible that something like this could be going on. But quite a long time later, in 93 and 94, Etoft and Susskind started making a much bigger deal of this inequality. They said that if we can never excite more entropy than this, then we really shouldn't think of all these quantum field theory degrees of freedom as really being there. Right? They're a complete illusion, and then, you know, economy of our description of the world should tell us that we should get rid of them. And they came from a direction which was very active at the time, where you worried about the fact that black holes seemed, that scattering off of black holes seemed to be violating the unitarity of quantum mechanics. And they arrived at this fairly radical conclusion by thinking about how unitarity might be restored. But they called this the holographic principle because they concluded that the actual number of degrees of freedom in the world really scales with the area, so that you can think of as describing everything that happens in physics by putting little zeros and ones on the boundary of the region that you're trying to describe, and forgetting about the extensivity in the bulk. Now, there was a very dramatic confirmation of this idea, though I think one has to say, in all fairness, that this development did not directly follow from this one. There was a dramatic confirmation of this set of ideas in string theory through the ADS-CFT correspondence that was discovered a few years ago through the work of Maldacena and various other people, where it was discovered that in a certain kind of space-time, I'm going to draw time going upward, and the space-time looks like a soup can, okay, where the soup is space and time, and the can is the boundary of this. It's a funny kind of space and time because it really has a boundary that you can think for many purposes is sitting at finite distance. You can send a light signal out to this boundary and comes back to you after a finite time. Now, they showed that you can describe a certain string theory that lives inside here. That's the soup, right? By a conformal field theory that can be thought of as living on the soup can. Right? And that conformal field theory doesn't just, you know, it's not just a label which tells you that there are noodles in the soup and tomatoes. It tells you where each noodle is and where each chunk of tomato is located. I mean, it's an exact correspondence. Right? It tells you exactly what's going on in the bulk. And in fact, it is the only rigorous non-perturbative definition of quantum gravity in this bulk. Yes? Yes. So after the third objection, all the string theorists are going to have to go.
I don't think that there is really strong evidence yet that we can reconstruct processes in the bulk on, say, resolution scales less than the ADS radius scale. No one has ever really done that and said, you know, say if we were living in that tin can, said how we can describe the kinds of processes that we saw.
That's right. Look, I mean, there are so many things. This is not the topic of my talk. But I think it's a fair statement to make that the CFT that lives here on this boundary is the best description that we have of quantum gravity in this space-time.
Yes, but it's clearly incomplete.
No, I don't think so. That's fine. That could be said about most of our theories. So, in any case, so this story here was interesting, not just because it naively realizes this hope that you can describe physics in the bulk by a theory that lives on the boundary, but there's a specific number here, right, that you have to get right. I mean, it's clear that with infinitely many fields, you can always reduce dimensions. Right? But the point is that you need to have this many states for describing a de Sitter space that you cut off at some finite area A. So if you don't go all the way out to infinity. And up to factors of order 1, which they weren't able to fix, Susskind and Witten showed that that comes out right. And it's not too surprising that we see this idea of the holographic principle realized in a quantum gravity theory, because it is an idea that connects quantum states and matter and space-time, you know, into one sentence, effectively. So it's hard to see how you would I would understand where this bound comes from, other than if you understand quantum gravity.
So I think you register the rejection. So you're not going to get the scale of substitution. But I just mentioned that it's not obvious to me, a priori, that their factor of order one, the estimate, is not actually infinity.
Okay, maybe I can invite the string theorists to give other talks about this, but there's only so many technical subtleties that I can hope to go into in a colloquium that I'm addressing to a general audience. And I'd request that you keep questions to a level of generality that everybody can benefit from. Thanks. I'm not going to go through the Susskind-Witten calculation and argue about subtleties. Now, a sociological fact was that after this happened, people were very, very excited about this idea of a Toft and Susskind, that somehow you should always go to the boundary and find a theory that lives on the boundary, and that will give you quantum gravity for the bulk. This space-time here, Andy, the Sitter space. Yeah. Yes, so he was one of the people who argued in the context of string theory that there is a severe dimensional reduction going on when you quantize the theory in the light cone gauge, and that's an observation that probably ties in with these ideas, but it's a slightly different line of the story. So the problem with the idea, sorry, yes.
Right.
Well, that's precisely the point. So now that you've gone to a theory without gravity, the holographic bound on entropy becomes trivial. Right? G is zero for that conformal field theory. So there's no more holographizing that you can do at this point. Right? You can't reduce any further because the bound just tells you that the entropy is always less than infinity. The Planck length is zero. You can't continue playing this game. So the holographic principle is something that has content only as long as you have gravity. So what happened here is that to compare numbers, you have to compare finite numbers, right? So you have to ask the question, which states in the conformal field theory? So the conformal field theory as such has infinitely many states. Right? The bulk, because this radius is actually of infinite proper length, also has infinitely many states. Okay. So the only way you can compare anything is if you place an infrared cutoff in the ADS space, and then you get some finite area. And then you have to understand some facts about the correspondence between the gravity in the bulk and this conformal field theory to understand what this infrared cutoff translates into in the conformal field theory. What is the corresponding thing I need to do to the conformal field theory to describe only the states that are left over after the infrared cutoff? And it turns out that a strong argument can be made that that's an ultraviolet cutoff that you have to introduce here. And that ends up giving you a finite, that ends up basically graining that cylinder and giving you, you know, a finite number of bits, if you will. So what unfortunately didn't work out very well is this hope that we could now go ahead and get quantum gravity for lots of different spacetimes by just looking at their boundary and trying to come up with some very clever theory that in some sense lives on that boundary. One of the reasons why this doesn't work is that the boundary structure, say, of Minkowski space or of de Sitter space, other important simple spacetimes that we'd like to understand, is very, very different from the structure of anti-de Sitter space, where it was so convenient to have essentially one slice of the boundary for every time slice in the bulk. But it's worse than that, because there are many interesting universes one would probably like to understand where you have no boundary at all. You can think about a closed universe that starts out in a Big Bang, expands, and recollapses, and every spatial slice is a three-dimensional sphere without any boundary. So what does it mean to write down a holographic description on the boundary? In fact, it's still worse than that. Right? And what is the main problem is that this bound is simply not generally valid. And unlike Don, I'm not going to worry about hypothetical matter systems that I don't think can be sure exist in nature and ask what would be going wrong with this argument. But in fact, it's at a much more unsophisticated level that this bound is already violated. It's violated by perfectly acceptable matter systems that we actually see in the universe. And the reason why that happens is indeed related to the kind of argument that Don was bringing up, which is you have to ask the question, when can we actually achieve this process? Right. And there are various levels of subtleties at which it can go wrong, but a very simple way it can go wrong is if my matter system is already sitting inside a black hole, say, that has much larger area than this area A, then I can't convert it into a black hole of area A anymore. Right? The key thing here was I could add some mass and turn it into a black hole of the same area. But if gravity is already strong in here to start with, then I can't count on doing that. Right? And so in such situations, it's not surprising that we can... Let's see, can this one be lifted too? No. Okay. So let me use this blackboard. That we can construct a whole set of counterexamples to this idea that the entropy of matter is always smaller than the area of the boundary. So one such counterexample would be, we have a star. And again, I'm drawing time going upward. So this disk here would be my star. I have to suppress a dimension. It would be my star at some early time. And then the star burns out and it starts collapsing. And it forms a black hole with some horizon right here. And for the outside observer, everything is fine. Right? The star had some entropy. S matter down here. But presumably, the entropy of the black hole horizon at late times is larger than that. And so for the outside observer, things are probably OK. But Einstein taught us that the laws of physics have to be the same for all observers. So if this S is less than A thing is supposed to be a law of physics, then it better be true for the guy who's sitting in here and watching the last seconds of the star before it forms some kind of singularity when it's collapsing into a single point. So this is some guy inside the black hole, and he can draw the surface of the star at a very late time, and it's clearly arbitrarily small. Just go to a late enough time before it's crunched into the singularity. But it's hard to see how the entropy of the star could have decreased. That would be a violation of the second law. So there must still be as much matter entropy in this interior as there was in the beginning. And it follows that if I take this area, which goes to zero, that sooner or later I will find that the entropy of the star is much greater than the area in Planck units. Okay? So that's clearly a problem. But it's not hard to see why things went wrong, right? I clearly could not have converted the star at this point into a black hole that has only this area. Now, there are various other examples.
Don't you need a very ordered state to get the thing to be very small?
No, so you can show that as you approach the singularity. So what I'm drawing here is a very inaccurate drawing, and here's a slightly more accurate one where you have a Penrose diagram, and light travels at 45 degrees, and here's the star. And I can always pick my area to sit here and enclose a space-like slice that contains the entire star. But because this is the singularity of the black hole, that means that this area really does go to zero. And this is outside of the star. So here, I don't have to worry about the back reaction from the star. All right. So this is kind of an important counterexample because this presumably happens all the time in the real universe, right? Now, here's another one. Actually, I should leave a little room for fixing it later. So our second problem is, again, our own universe. This time, quite directly, we seem to be living in a spatially flat, expanding space-time. And the entropy content on large scales in our universe can be approximated by an entropy density. If you average over large enough scales, it's more or less the same amount of entropy per volume. And so the entropy in a ball of radius r at a given time is simply this fixed entropy density, fixed if I've specialized to one moment of time, right, times the radius of that ball. Because I live in because the spatial geometry is just ordinary Euclidean geometry. I can use the usual relations between volume and radius and between area and radius. And because this goes like the third power and this goes like the second power, as long as this guy here is positive, sooner or later I will have entropy much greater than area. I just have to choose that radius large enough. So this is the flat expanding universe. It turns out that to actually get violations, I have to choose the radius to be ridiculously large, much larger than the Hubble radius in our universe. But still. And in this case, of course, this argument breaks down because even though this is not inside a black hole, the space that's occupied by this ball of radius r is expanding at an incredible rate because it occupies a region that's bigger than a Hubble radius. So opposite ends are accelerating away faster than the speed of light in some mathematical sense. And so it's not possible to convert them into a black hole of the same area. Now, here are two more counterexamples which are extremely simple to draw, and that's why I will talk about them even though they're perhaps overkill at this point. So let me draw the area. So suppose we live in a closed universe. Okay, so this is supposed to represent a three-sphere, which I'm drawing as a two-sphere because I don't know any better. And I can find a small two-sphere on that three-sphere, which I can perfectly well regard as the boundary of this volume. Right? But it's clear that I can make the entropy in this volume arbitrarily large, and I can make this two-sphere arbitrarily small. So in the case of a closed universe, spatially closed, I mean here, I also have the same problem. And finally, this is perhaps the most ridiculous example of all. It's even true for our room that I can violate this bound. So here's our room drawn in space-time. So time is going upward, and this would be our room at one instant. Okay. Now, it is in fact true that if I use the ordinary way of picking a boundary of our room, if I use this area, A1, then that's certainly larger than the entropy in this room. But this is just one way of picking a time coordinate, setting one particular time coordinate to a fixed value. I can have different time coordinates, and I can have time coordinates where time equals constant corresponds to a boundary of the room. I should have done this in red. which is almost moving at the speed of light. It's still space-like. There's still a spatial separation between this point and that point. But it's like measuring the length of this wall with a spaceship that's flying past at some incredibly fast speed. Because of Lorentz contraction, it looks at this wall as actually very short. And for that very same reason, this area is actually extremely small and can be made arbitrarily small. So this area goes to zero, and hence we once again have our usual problem. And note that in all four of these examples, these violations aren't subtle. They don't involve things that we could argue about whether they may be completely unphysical. And they're essentially entropy over area is infinity over zero, right? We're not arguing about a factor of two, right? They're blatant violations. So what went wrong? Well, there are two options, and ultimately both of these options are still open. But I think there's a development that I want to tell you about that makes one of them perhaps more likely. So option number one is that this whole stuff about the entropy being less than the area is actually garbage, right? It doesn't mean anything. It's not very general. You know, if you have a bound that is always true except when it isn't, there's nothing you can do with that. And it certainly wouldn't tell us anything deep about quantum gravity in that case, right? It's particularly ironic that it's violated most easily when gravity is strong. But the other possibility, which I think has, you know, a better chance of being correct, is that in this original version, we just didn't formulate the bound quite right. Right? That there's a better way of stating it, which maybe we can't derive by thinking about black holes, or not even heuristically argue that it comes out of some Gedanken experiment a la Bekenstein. But maybe there's just simply a statement about nature that is generally true, and that reduces to something like the bound I originally wrote down in appropriate circumstances. But at this point, of course, all that we can do is guesswork. And the strategy is going to be to look for a more general reformulation. Now, there are different things you can do. You can change the left side of the bound, or you can change the right side. Something has to give. What I did was not change the right side. Still the area. But on the left, instead of looking at the entropy in some volume of space whose boundary is this area, what turns out to perform significantly better is if we replace volume by something called a light sheet, which is a different kind of geometric object, though often it amounts to pretty much doing the same thing. And I'm about to explain what that light sheet is, since that's the main content of the statement. This thing is called the covariant entropy bound. The original paper is in 99, but there's a review which is probably better to read on HEPPH with this number. So so what can we do if we don't want to talk about the entropy inside a volume anymore? Well, there are some clues that come from these last two examples about what kind of properties the bound should have. What clearly went totally wrong here is that our intuitive notion of what is inside the area was violated by this example, right? It's clear immediately that some sphere that I can draw here in the middle of this room shouldn't have anything to do with the entropy in the rest of the universe, whether or not the universe is closed, right? There has to be something in the bound that knows about what is the inside of the area. And that is why our strategy is, in fact, no longer to start with a spatial volume and then, you know, figure out what is the area of its boundary, But to start with a two-dimensional surface with some area, and then construct some 2 plus 1 dimensional, well, not really volume, but something close to it, light sheet, and then look on the look at the entropy on that light sheet. So we're doing it backwards in some sense. Okay. And that allows us to make sure that we're going in an inside direction, according to a rule that I'll discuss in a minute. The other thing that went horribly wrong is that the statement basically violated covariance. I mean, the entropy of which volume bounded by this area? Right? A given area, depending on which time coordinate I choose, can bound several different volumes. There was nothing relativistic about the statement. It was, in some sense, observer dependent. So we need something that's covariant. And that pretty much reduces our options considerably. So I'm going to draw time going upward. This would be an instant of time. And this would be some two-dimensional area at that instant of time. Okay. And I should have probably drawn this area in red so that we can later recognize it after all the scribblings. Okay. Now, we don't want this area, we don't want to say that this area has anything to do with the interior of this disk here, which is really a ball, and which, you know, has already not worked. Okay. And in any case, which one would it be? We could deform this up or down a little bit. It would still be an interior. The one thing that you can do pretty uniquely, and which is covariant, is you can look at the light rays that emanate from this surface orthogonally. So it's like having little laser guns that all flash up, you know, on the boundary of this room, and then the light rays travel towards the center. But as they do that, they move up through time as well. So it's not going to be space and information, it's space, time, and information. That's why the title contains time. It's important that they move up through time, as we'll see in a minute. So now we can look at the entropy on this. This thing is called a light sheet of A. Okay. And we can look at the entropy on this light sheet the same way we looked at the entropy on this disk. Right? It's a snapshot of whatever matter systems happen to be moving through this space-time. Right. So here it would be this snapshot before it would have been this one. But it's the same story. In fact, you can think of this as a limiting case of space-like surfaces. The only difference is that one direction is now null. It moves at the speed of light. Okay. So then that's what I mean by the entropy on this light sheet. Just take all the matter systems that are intersected by the light sheet and add together their entropy. The problem is that there are, in fact, four, not just two, but in fact, four null sides to any surface. I could have also sent these light rays to the past, and I could have sent the light rays to the other side, which in this picture looks like it's the outside. Right, so there are really four options. Now, the only rule involved here is in picking the right options. And it's now very simple. All that we need to do is follow the light rays a little bit away from the area A in each one of these four options and check whether the area is getting smaller. Right. Here it's getting smaller. So this cone here is OK. That's like going to the inside. Here it's getting larger. So we're not going to allow this. This is not a light sheet. This is not a light sheet. This is a light sheet. The statement is supposed to be true for any light sheet of the area A. So in this case, there are two statements I can make. Okay. There's one additional rule that, it's not really an additional rule, but it's something to note, which is that, of course, if I don't pay attention, where do I stop? I mean, it's not always going to be as nice as this cone. It's not going to be so symmetric. How did I know to stop here? Well, the thing is that this question of increasing or decreasing cross-sectional area is one I can ask about each light ray and its neighbors. It's quite a local thing. Either they move together or they move apart. As soon as they start moving apart, I have to stop. For most practical purposes, that means I stop when they start intersecting. Okay. Of course, I can stop sooner if I want. Okay, so what I want to do to finish this talk are essentially two things. I want to show that this reduces to our previous statement and in fact gives you a more precise condition under which you can expect this more space-like bound to be correct. And I want to say how these problems get resolved. Okay. The first thing is actually very simple. In fact, you might have objected here that this is nothing new. Right? I'm talking about the entropy on the light sheet is in fact exactly the same thing as the entropy on that disk. Unless maybe the entropy increased a little bit between here and there. But the light sheet captures all the same matter system that we're already at in this volume here that's enclosed by the area. But for that statement to be true, I actually have to make some assumptions that I implicitly made in this drawing, which is that a future-directed light sheet exists, right? That I have a family of light rays orthogonal to my surface that has non-increasing area, and that it completely closes off. Right? If there was some collapse singularity that might cut off this cone before all the light rays meet, and then I might miss some matter system that goes out through the middle here. Okay, and in fact, you can think about these two assumptions, that the future light sheet exists and that it's complete, as being a more precise version of saying that gravity is weak. But in that limit, it is true that the entropy in some volume enclosed by A, which by the second law has to be less than the entropy by the time the matter gets up to the light sheet, has to be less than A over 4. Right? So we do recover the original statement when those assumptions are justified. And to see that things start going right here, it's actually a good thing that I got this question earlier. So what happens for the collapsing star is you're inside a black hole. Space is contracting incredibly violently. Okay. What that means is that when you construct a light sheet off of some sphere, in fact, it doesn't matter whether you send your light rays to what you thought was the outside or to the inside. The actual area of these along the light rays is always decreasing towards the future because as the light rays are trying to run out, underneath them, the fabric of space is pulling them so quickly towards the center that they're not winning. Okay, so that means we can only consider future-directed light sheets. And so, for example, from this area, we can't consider a light sheet that would go down towards the path and see all of the star. Okay. So we have to look at the future-directed one. And to really see what happens there, you need a little bit more math than I put into this drawing. You basically need this Penrose diagram. And that shows you that when you get very close to the singularity, as you need to be to make this area small, the light rays don't have enough time as they move forward in time to get to the center of the star. They only probe a small shell on the outside of the star before everything collapses to a singularity. Okay, so they actually don't see all of the entropy of the star. And you need to do quantitative checks, which I'm not going to perform here, to see that things work out for, say, a given collapse solution. But it's all I'm going to do here is show you that these obvious violations are no longer there. In the flat expanding universe, it's exactly the opposite story. This is our time, and here's the Big Bang. And if I choose a chunk of our universe that's too big, then the past directed light sheets don't complete. They don't see all of the matter. They only see sort of an annulus or a shell. Right? They miss this stuff. So the volume would not have missed that and I would have had problems. But the light sheet, this guy, is okay. And of course the reason why I draw the past directed light sheets and not future directed ones is that because of the expansion of the universe, the future directed ones are not allowed. No matter which way I send my light rays, if I send them to the future, the cross-sectional area will grow because space is expanding so rapidly. So it's sort of the time reverse of the earlier example. This example, you can see immediately that, well, the cross-sectional area increases if I went that way and decreases if I go to the center of the polar cap here. So I was never allowed to compare this entropy to this area when I use this rule. And here, it's a bit hard to see this, perhaps, But if I look at this from the top, so forgetting about time, then the light rays away from this surface just skim the outside. They come out slanted. And they don't see what's in the room. Okay? They look like this. So it's an evasive maneuver, right? The way you solve the problem is by seeing less entropy. But now you have a general statement, and a statement that you could have never inferred by staring at black hole thermodynamics long enough. It's far more general. As Don and collaborators showed, can be viewed as a generalization of the statement of the generalized second law for black holes in those cases where you create a black hole from a situation where you didn't have one before, and they then propose the generalization of the bound, or noted that you can write one down, in which the generalized second law is implied for all processes involving black holes. The key thing to notice there is that the horizon of a black hole is just a special case of a light sheet. It's a null hypersurface. It consists of the light rays that are just barely not making it out of the black hole. So everything that you can do with light sheets, you can then specialize to black holes. But it's far more general, and so I think it represents a pattern that we can just keep on testing, but which we don't really understand from any fundamental point of view. And the hope is that it's a pattern that is betraying something about the way in which matter and space and time come out of a quantum theory of gravity. The hope is that if you understand that, it's going to be clear from the start that you can never have more information than on a light sheet than its area. Thanks very much.
Duncan?
I think it's not difficult to be more careful with the examples and idealize the situations where you can be sure that that's not happening. One good way to start might be to start by already having a big black hole there, and then throwing in some enormous star that has an enormous entropy. Then you don't have to worry about how you made the black hole, how violent the processes are there, whether you're shedding part of the star as the black hole is formed, because then as it crosses the event horizon, that's just a perfectly ordinary calm part of space-time. That's a very good question. So if this is my area, I have these four options, and I always have these four options that I can start by looking at. I mean, it's a fact of geometry. Just like in space, every surface has two sides. In space-time, every surface has four null sides. Okay. At every point, in other words, I can uniquely construct two orthogonal null vectors. Now, what you can ask, and perhaps what you're asking, is how can I be sure that there is at least one light sheet? In other words, how can I be sure that the area is not expanding in all four directions? And it depends on how many assumptions I put in. But there, in general relativity, if you want to ask the question, do I have a solution of Einstein's equation? You always have that problem that you can write down any metric, calculate the Einstein tensor, and set it equal to some matter stress energy. The only thing that you can use to distinguish between rubbish and a solution is whether that stress energy of the matter is anything resembling physical, right? And to have nice compact ways of talking about what we might consider to be physical, there are these energy conditions. One of the weakest of these energy conditions is called the null energy condition. And it says that if you have a stress tensor and contract it twice with any null vector, that has to be non-negative. Okay. Assuming that the null energy condition holds in our space-time, that basically translates into the statement that light waves never anti-focus. Okay. So that means that you can't have the light ray, the area along this set of, this is really the same set of light rays, right? The future ingoing and past outgoing ones. You can't have the area increasing in both of these directions because that would correspond to an anti-focusing kind of shape. Right? The light rays would come in like this and then anti-focus and become larger again. So as long as this is true, there will always be at least two light sheets. Because I'm demanding not that the expansion is less than zero, but only that it's less than or equal to zero.
I guess I would worry about something a little more subtle, where some parts of the area are focusing on other parts that are going in one direction and the reverse field.
That becomes a Malebolge area.
Oh, I see. Wait, so you mean we pick an area like this? Well, so... No, so I mean, you can always, as long as we're in the regime of classical gravity, you can always pick a two-dimensional area, right? I mean, I'm just assuming you're given a solution, a 3+1-dimensional solution. By the way, this generalizes to higher dimensions trivially, but let's just, and you can just pick an area, okay? And then, of course, it might be true that you have picked an area in which has the property that the direction of the ingoing light rays, and let me just draw this in a spatial way, changes from here to there. You know, it's here now. Here's the shrinking direction. Here's the shrinking direction. Right, so that can happen. But the nice thing about this definition of insight is that it's local and can be talked about for each light ray and its neighbors. So you can make this statement of the covariant entropy bound not just for closed surfaces, which we needed in the old days because insight was where infinity wasn't. But you can talk about open surfaces and their inside directions, right? I can start with a surface like this. And I still know what the inside is. It's this direction. So that gives me a handle on situations like this. I just chop up my surface and then do things piece by piece. Yeah, I mean, of course, in most, I don't know of any situations where it would be interesting to explore the bound for a surface like this, right? In fact, you're going to get a tighter statement by trying to find a more, by then trying to find a surface in which, you know, you minimize the area, but you somehow see a lot of entropy. For that, you need to study the solution and just figure out how to place the surface. But that's always true, right? You need to think a little bit about what is the most interesting way in a given situation to test the bound.
Isn't that case taken care of by this generalization of Mara at all?
Which case?
The case you just threw, the funny case, which sometimes it goes out sometimes. Yeah. Because then they just run it for some delta t, right? Some small t.
Well,
or the light rays actually meet each other.
I don't think there's any correlation between, I mean, What they allow you to do is something different. They allow you to take the light sheet not as far as you could have,
and then
tighten the bound in exchange for that.
Right.
Right.
Okay. So doesn't that take care of that case?
Steve.
So more general question. You found some very beautiful results regarding area and entropy or information. But what do you think is more fundamental, that or the bound relating, say, area and energy? We know, for example, that you can only get so much energy into a given area, so to speak. And on the other hand, it looks like you can, well, it looks like that might be a bound that you could, well, that might imply this bound.
Well, a bound relating area to energy is basically a part of general relativity. It's a part of a theory we already know, and there's nothing mysterious about it. Right? What's happening? Why does this have some chance of working? Right? It has some chance of working because there is an equation in general relativity that tells you, as I move along the light rays with some parameter lambda along the light rays, and I have this quantity theta that measures the expansion, how they're moving apart or together, that you get focusing from various things, from the expansion itself, and from shear, and from the matter. And this is, of course, in the context that I've been talking about, the most important contribution. So every time you meet some matter, that matter has a stress tensor, it has energy, and it basically makes the light ray, the light sheet smaller. That is something that we understand very well because of, this is just a consequence of Einstein's equation. What's so mysterious is, thank you, is that it seems that we, with realistic matter that we know exists, that for a given entropy, there's always enough energy that you focus the light rays quickly enough that they run into caustics, right? But that's the part that's somewhat mysterious. You can make assumptions about local relations or average local relations between energy density and entropy density, and that's also what Don and collaborators did. But you know, ultimately, we would like to understand from a fundamental point of view, why is it that energy and entropy seem to be constrained in such a way in the real world? We can certainly, you know, imagine systems where they wouldn't be, and so I think the interesting part of the statement is the relation between entropy and area, and not between energy and area.
Well, that's certainly a part that combines the other two parts that are interesting. Let's leave it at that.
Lance?
So if W turns out to be less than minus one, is that condition still satisfied?
W less than minus 1 violates the dominant energy condition. Does it violate the null energy condition? It does, yeah. So, it probably does.
So, it may be reasonable, but it may not be true.
Right. No, that's right. But, I don't think we have... So in particular, the statement of the bound is not supposed to hold true for this or that energy condition necessarily. It's just that that's the best we can do if we want to test it in a well-defined arena. Ultimately, the bound is going to be useful if it holds true for the matter that exists in the universe. Right? It hasn't been demonstrated. For example, you can violate most of these energy conditions in small enough space-time regions using quantum effects. You can have negative energy density, right? But it hasn't been demonstrated that you can use this negative energy density to violate this bound. Right. So these energy conditions are definitely crutches, right? They're just helping us to define an arena in which we might want to explore it. And if we observe types of matter that violate this condition, then that in itself is not a tragedy, but then we need to check whether you can violate the bound with it. And then, of course, if you can, then that's that.
Further questions? If not, let's thank the speaker again.